It's a great pleasure to be here. And what I want to share some thoughts with you about is where the world is going, and particularly how we manage it over the coming decades. The extraordinary thing about this period that we live in, and I think about this as the period since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the last 20 years or so, is that walls have come down throughout the world. It's a period of hyperconnectivity, of blinds being lifted, and of people being connected. And this is a most extraordinary phenomena, which led as well to my being here, in the sense that I had been in exile from South Africa, and South Africa transformed in the 90s, 94, President Mandela became president. And in that period, we have seen dictatorships fall and authoritarian regimes fall in over 70 countries around the world. So what started in the late 80s with the opening up of Eastern Europe is a process that has continued and led to democratization across Latin America, much of Africa and Asia, and the opening up, of course, of China as well. And it continues in a most remarkable way with the Arab Spring, with the revolutions in North Africa and elsewhere. So this process is by no means over, and it's a process of political transformation at a pace which is unlike anything in history, given not only the speed of change, but the breadth of change, the number of countries that are involved. So a process of connectiveness, of opening up, of transformation, which has simultaneously occurred with an increase in the world's population of about 2 billion over this period from the late 80s to now. Many more people densely packed in urban areas, over half the world's population now urbanized, and connected with those around the world. So physical and virtual proximity in a very different way to anything that happened in the world before. The yellow in this figure depicts people that are less than an hour away from a major city. And that's two-thirds of the world's population now, less than 1 hour away from a major city. So extraordinary potential to come together, to see things in new ways. And with this, and a mass of education, 500 million more tertiary educated people in the world over this period, and about a billion new people educated in all ways. And not only people who would previously have been educated, but new possibilities. People that were previously in the slums. And it's just about not only the physical, but the virtual. So people who don't have the opportunity to go to great universities like Warwick can find themselves with the same knowledge base through a computer. So this online potential, which we're just beginning to realize and is just taking off, is also going to lead to an extraordinary growth in the ability of people to connect and connect ideas. Now, when people come together and they connect their ideas, the most amazing things happen. They leapfrog. They throw away their old ideas and take on new ideas. And you get this process of creative destruction. But it's creative destruction at a pace which has never been seen before. And at a scale in terms of the number of people in the world that are rapidly evolving their ideas, that's never been seen before. And that's why we live in a period which I believe is characterized and will be characterized by the most rapid innovation and change the world has ever known. It's a period you can characterize as a new renaissance, a period of the most remarkable creativity, of opportunity, of things that will happen that we cannot begin to foresee, but with it, people have been able to live longer, healthier lives. There's absolutely no reason why in our lifetimes we should not see the end of poverty and disease. It is possible because of this capability of people coming together and finding new ways of seeing things. What this graphic depicts is a regression between agglomeration, concentration of people, and income growth. And what you see is this very clear relationship up to about 10 million people when you start getting congestion effects, pollution effects, and other effects. And this is about urbanization. But it's not only about people in urban areas. It's about people connecting ideas because they connected through the internet and they're educated and literate. There are lots of ways of depicting the changes in these levels of flows since about 1990. But because I'm an economist, I look at economic flows, financial flows, and what you see here is very stable flows up to about 1990, and then very different orders of magnitude following that period. The top line is foreign direct investment. The one immediately below it on this right-hand axis is remittances, so what migrant workers send home. The one below that, which is very unstable, is portfolio investment, which is bond and equity flows, and the bottom line is aid flows. All of them unstable, and they've remained very unstable, but the point is they're different orders of magnitude to what they were before about 1990. And this would be true of any flow you look at. And of course, if you look at virtual flows, internet flows, mobile traffic flows, etc., in terms of telephone connectivity, you would see exactly the same thing. Internet, of course, only invented in the 90s. Now, because of this extraordinary ability to churn ideas and to develop new ideas, people are escaping poverty at a more rapid rate than ever in history. And emerging markets, on average, are catching up with the older OECD economies. So the average growth rates in the emerging markets are now about 5%. The average in the old OECD economies between 1 and 2%. And so you get this convergence. China and Asia, over the next 20 years, I believe, will continue to grow at growth rates of 7 to 9%. Now, although people fret a bit about China's growth slowing down, we need to put this in perspective. Our economy in the UK has never grown by more than 4% for a 10-year period in any time in recorded history. Okay. And we worry about China, which has doubled its income every 8 to 10 years over the last 30 years, slowing to 7%. It's been growing at about 9% over the last decade. So these are very extraordinary times. Brazil has been growing at 4 to 5%. The average growth rate for Africa is 5%. We've never achieved that in Europe over a sustained period of time, and that's been the average for Africa over the last 10 years. So these are remarkable times, and they're very exciting in terms of their potential, particularly the potential for people to escape poverty. When you compound these sorts of growth rates, you get the most remarkable things. You get China over the period to about 2050 having the income levels of Southern Europe today, Spain, Portugal, Greece, and not far off from where the UK is today, just depending on the assumptions we make. Most of the emerging markets become middle income over this period. The question is, how do you get there? The question is, can we manage the transition path, and what are the implications of all of this? So the top line is China, the dashed line below it is India, and the bottom dark line is Africa. And you see China going up in this graphic to about $35,000 per capita, India to about 10, and Africa to about 5, sub-Saharan Africa. At these levels of income, there's absolutely no reason for anyone to be dying of starvation or poverty, etc. These are very decent levels of income where one can afford basic needs. Certainly, that's true on average for India at $10,000. The challenge for the world is that as these economies develop over the next 10, 20 years, they go through a peak of consumption of goods and services and energy. So societies maximize their energy use at about $7,000 per capita. That is, for every marginal amount of money they earn, they maximize the amount of it that they spend on fuel, because they start buying energy-intensive goods and services, heaters, air conditioners, fridges, microwaves, cars, small cars getting bigger with higher fuel consumption. They start traveling more. And they start consuming food that is processed and energy intensive. So you move from having grain to having chicken to having pizza or hamburgers, and in the process you move up the energy intensity scale, and you also move dramatically up the water, land, and other resource use scale. So about 100 times more resources are required for a hamburger or a pizza than are required for a bowl of grain or rice in terms of water, land, energy, and everything else that goes along with it. And about 2 billion people will be going through this transition path over the next 20 years. So it's a most remarkable time, but it's also a time that will require extraordinary management and ability to ensure that it does not become a perfect storm. It's very important when one worries about the future to first focus on the extraordinary positive story. What you have here in green is arithmetic scale population, and in red, exponential scale income growth. Red scale on the right, population scale on the left. And what you see over this 2,000-year period is just how extraordinary this time we live in is. It's a period when income growth has exceeded population growth, despite the most rapid growth the world's ever known in population. There was a period about 1,000 years ago when income growth exceeded population growth. And that period, like this period now, was a period of connectivity. People migrated. Europe and Asia connected and shared ideas and leapfrogged because they adopted ideas that had taken thousands of years to develop in other localities. It's that swapping of ideas and integration that is a most remarkable story. There was a period about 500 years ago, the Renaissance. It doesn't even show up on these long-term graphics. It ended, of course, very quickly in tragedy. The bonfire of the vanities, the burning of books, the Inquisition, mass bigotry and fundamentalism in the world, and of course slavery, which became much larger after this period too. Had existed long before, but it was systematized after this period. So the question of this current period is this sustainable? Is this level of connectivity and integration with all the benefits sustainable, and where do we go from here? Can we have a continuation of these sorts of curves, or does it come to some crash landing like the Renaissance did? And that's what really interests me, and that's what I think about when I think about globalization. And by globalization, I mean integration, connectivity, and flows between societies. So to give a sense of what's happened in this period, average life expectancy has increased over the last 30 years by about 20 years. That took from the Stone Age to the 1970s to get an average increase on the world of 20 years in life expectancy. Something very, very peculiar and unique has happened. Illiteracy in the world, the number of people that can read and write, has gone down from about 50% to about 22% over this period. And the absolute number of people in dire poverty, which the World Bank defines as under $1 a day, has gone down by about 300 million, despite the world's population increasing by about 2 billion. Historically, as the world's population increased, the number of absolutely poor people increased with it, even if the relative share declined. So this is a very different period. There are two things that I worry deeply about in thinking about the sustainability question. The first is this, that the process has not been associated with progressive things for everyone. Some people have got poorer. Globalization has not been shared. Indeed, it's been associated with growing inequality. Inequality within countries, virtually all countries, as they get more open, have become more unequal. And also, if you take the full spectrum of countries, inequality between countries. Now, I did mention that the emerging markets are growing at 3 to 5 times the rate of the old OECD economies. That implies convergence. But unfortunately, there's about 25 countries at the bottom of the spectrum who are falling back. Failed states, states in conflict, and other states who have negative growth or zero growth. If you take the full spectrum, there's a divergence between countries as well as within countries. This is a photograph of Sao Paulo, but it could equally be Manila or Johannesburg or many other places. So this is an aspect which I believe needs to be dealt with because it will lead to an unsustainable and uncohesive society. If we're to manage globalization, and I will show that I think this is urgently required, then we need societies that believe they have a shared stake in it. We need a world that believes it has a shared stake in it, that what happens to one happens to all. And that's really the question of systemic shocks and systemic risk. When we open our doors, wonderful things come through. Good ideas, new medicines, new opportunities, new technologies that transform our lives for the better. But unfortunately, bad things come through too. Pandemics, cyber attacks, terrorists, financial crises. And so the greatest challenge is how do you manage hyperconnectivity and the increased level of these flows without also becoming much more vulnerable to the shocks that cascade with them? How do you have openness and connectivity without vulnerability? How do you build resilience? How do you ensure that you are able to select the parts of globalization that you like and keep out the parts you don't? This is the greatest challenge of globalization, I believe, of our time. I'll come back to this, but let me just focus on some of the mega trends going forward. And in this, I'm going to draw a lot on the work that's going on across the Oxford Martin School. We're about 400 people now across Oxford working in teams, solving some of the biggest challenges of the future in new interdisciplinary ways. And among them, we're looking at demographic, economic, and technological trends. I'll give you a very quick snapshot of some of the findings from this. The extraordinary thing on demography is just the range of uncertainty only 38 years out to 2050. It's not far ahead. 4 billion people uncertainty over this period. That's about two-thirds of the current population of the planet, almost 60% of the current population of the planet. Uncertainty, with enormous consequences for everything one thinks about. The trend line is coming down everywhere. All regions are experiencing slower population growth than in the past. The only question is how fast. There's convergence because life expectancy is growing at increasingly similar rates around the world, at least 2 years per decade, and in many places much more as they catch up. So while we have our one-hour session together, your life expectancy will increase by at least 10 minutes on average. This is the pace of progress that's happening in the world, both because of things that you might be learning, don't drive your cars so fast, don't smoke as much, wear a safety belt, public health, but mainly because of what's happening in the labs, and I'll give you some sense of that. This is happening around the world. When you compound this, you get the most remarkable thing. 700 million people in Asia over the age of 65 by 2025. Rapid growth everywhere, but the sheer numbers in Asia are very strong. Now, unfortunately, there is one region of the world which is a real anomaly, and that's Southern Africa. While life expectancy on average has increased by about 20 years in the rest of the world, it's gone down over the same period in Southern Africa by 20 years. And that's because of the ravages of HIV/AIDS. The other anomaly is Russia, where life expectancy has gone down by about 7 years on average over this period for very different reasons. So the one story globally is increasing longevity, a very powerful driver, and the other side of the story is collapsing fertility. And this is even more dramatic than the increasing longevity. With all regions of the world coming down below replacement level, and this happening most rapidly in emerging markets. Already the 10 countries with the lowest fertility rates are emerging markets. And this is not China's one-child policy. its neighbors have lower fertility rates than it does. Taiwan, South Korea, Hong Kong with no policies. This is when women get educated, when they get jobs, when they get urbanized, they decide to have less children. So when you run this through to the future, you get a very different type of different demographic structure. And we have to erase from our mental maps ideas of population pyramids and put in their place something like this. If you're aesthetically minded, you might think of it as a vase. But if you're an economist like me, you might think about it as a coffin. This is the future of the societies, with enormous consequences for politics and for economics. Of course, the people at the bottom three cohorts or so can't vote. So you see who's going to dominate the politics here, the elderly. They are going to be very worried about their social security, about their retirement, about their health policies. And there's going to be enormous burden on the youth, tax and other burden. People will live much longer. The average compact in our retirement policies was that your expectation was that you would live about 7 years after retirement. That's when the system was built that we have today. But currently, life expectancy on retirement is already 26 years and rising by at least 2 years a decade. So people won't want to retire. They won't afford to retire. The existing system of retirement and pensions will be thrown out the window, and people will work well into their 70s and 80s. The problem is that neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, are lagging about 20 years behind the progress being made with physical regeneration. So we have a lot of very elderly people who are mentally incapacitated. That's for the next 20 or 30 years. After that, you speak to the neuroscientists, you get a very optimistic picture that people will live into their hundreds and be physically and mentally able. So we're going through a perfect storm in terms of dependency ratios and in terms of needs of elderly people over this period of the next 20 or 30 years. Every country is different, and the peculiarities are obviously very significant for those countries. China, much more the sort of skyscraper structure, and that's because of its one-child policy, which has been sustained over a long period of time. But again, the details are very important. The provinces of China already, where there's 13 boys for every 10 girls at the age of one. So gender inequality, increasingly significant. As people decide to have less and less children, their choice of the gender of that child becomes more and more significant to them. And when you live in a society, as all societies unfortunately are, where the status, the income, and the other opportunities for men are greater than women, people decide to have boys. So we get a vicious circle with more boys, less brides, less women having children, and a more rapid downward spiral in populations. A very powerful reason for societies to become gender neutral. The other thing you'll notice from China, and I think you might have noticed it from this as well, is that women live longer than men. This is for no genetic reason. This is the best proof I have that women are wiser than men. They make better choices. They don't stick as many knives into each other. They don't drink as much. They don't drive as many cars into as many trees, etc. So they live longer. The problem for women is going to be that if they like men, they're not going to be many around in their old age. So the only advice I would have to women that like men is find a man and keep them healthy and sane. Otherwise, you're going to be very lonely when you're old. The U.S. is a much healthier sort of structure. It's a beehive structure. And that's entirely due to migration. Half the children being born in the U.S. today are being born to migrant first-generation families, although they're only about 10% of the population. Migration and what happens with migration is fundamental to the way that the world will evolve and societies will evolve over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And my book, Exceptional People, the subtitle is How Migration Shaped Our World and Will Define Our Future. I believe it will define our future. It will define our ability to innovate, attract, and develop as a society, to be competitive in the UK, and being in a university like this, the Vice Chancellor knows, as I do, how critical and difficult this issue is at the moment on skills and visas. But it's also about unskilled. It's about the dynamism of society. Silicon Valley would not exist without migrants. Every iconic firm you can think of was created by migrants. And half the startups and investment in Silicon Valley is migrant derived, although, as I mentioned, it's 10% of the population. So this is a great source of future strength for the US. And as we saw in the most recent election, it's also going to change the politics. In this process, the median age moves up rapidly. We move away from youth CEOs again to elderly, and a complete change in the nature of the retirement and work package and entry and exit from the labor force. Africa becomes the biggest workforce in the world by far over this period from about 2030. And the key question for Africa, is it a workforce? Is it 52 countries, many of whose economies are not much bigger than Warwickshire's? Or is it a skilled place that can mobilize resources? So migration is a very important part of this, partly because of these different growth rates in labor forces around the world. But even if migration was 10 times its current levels, and it's currently about 10 million migrants a year, it still wouldn't begin to compensate for the structural changes that are happening as the workforce goes down from about 800 million to about 600 million over the next 40 years or so. So other things will happen, and amongst the things that happen, are we going to change our views completely about when we work and how we work? To be much more flexible, to work much later in our lives, but also to have to reskill and retool ourselves, because you're not going to be wanting to work in your 80s on the basis of a degree you took 60 years before. So a whole different way of thinking about ongoing education. And China becomes the biggest economy in the world. It's just a question of when. Already half of economic activity in Asia. By 2050, 80% of world economic activity will be in what we now call emerging markets, 80%. So we will be the tail in 2050, a very small part. And with that, a transformation of politics. And clearly a very different world order by then. The challenge is, how do we get there? So we live in a very, very difficult time for many, many reasons. The perfect storm on resources, on population growth, on systemic risks, but also because we're in a period of perfect storm of politics at the global and national level. And that's because there's a handover, and in the process there's a vacuum. The old powers, what we used to call the G1, the US, or the G7, or the G3, Europe, Japan, and the US, are totally unfit and unable to manage. And they don't even want to. They're preoccupied in crisis management. They can fight no more wars. They can provide no more leadership. And yet the new powers, what some call the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are not ready to lead in any way. We thought there was a moment of G20, which was after the financial crisis. There was a meeting in London. We thought this was a new world order, but it dissipated, and now, like the G7 and G8 that went before it, it's basically a lunch club, a media circus, with prefabricated press releases for home audiences, but no capacity to manage, no executive power, no legitimacy even. So this is a very dangerous period, because as we navigate the perfect storm, we ask the question, whose hands are at the wheel? Who's going to be doing this? And the answer is, there's no one there. So we can imagine a future which is wonderful. A period which James Martin, who endowed the Oxford Martin School, thinks of as eco-affluence, where we live basically in harmony with the planet, doing things that don't destroy it, whatever we fancy. That is totally within our reach. It's just how you get there, and how do you share it equally. And I'll come back to that. Let me just touch on some of the technologies that will be in the background of this. The thing about technological change is that we need to be even more humble than in our projections, which will also always be wrong on other dimensions. And this is true of academics as well, as Lord Kelvin famously reminds us in this. And it's certainly true of inventors, who, there's a great book called Bad Predictions, which has about 1,000 bad predictions in it. But the biggest section is from business, predicting about where their business will go over the next 5 years or so. So, and this will become even more challenging as we evolve more rapidly. And famously, Bill Gates or Watson was one of these. So the things we thought were cool are no longer cool. But the things we think are cool today will be as ridiculous in 5 or 10 years' time. The pace of change is accelerating. And behind this is Moore's law, this extraordinary capacity to double computer processing power for the same price now about every 14 months. And when you speak to the computer experts, as I have done with our Future of Computing group, they say this is sustainable for at least the next 20 years or so. So we'll have power, we'll have objects, we'll have processes, we'll have things in the air which are a million times more powerful than those today for the same price. And what will they do? How will they help us? And what will they be providing? Part of this is obviously the digitalization. More words now being uploaded and documents, images every day than all of those created in history, and it growing at an exponential rate. And the price of the capacity growing even more rapidly, so we're moving to a world basically of free digital storage and uploading and downloading. Interestingly enough, more uploading than downloading. So we want to put our photographs and everything up there. Actually, not everyone wants to look at them. So, but this growing exponentially at these sorts of pace. So one key driver is the computing power, and with it, digitalization and many other dimensions of it. Another key driver is nano, or the dividing up and the creation now of manufacturing capacity at a nano level. This is from our nano lab in the Oxford Martin School. And what we're doing here is we're building an atomic needle at the atomic level, and we're driving it through a cell which is about 8/1,000,000 thick. The needle is about 5/1,000,000 wide. It's hollow. It's got a cancer drug in the middle. We're dropping it into a cell, and the time scale is 44/1,000,000. The ability to construct, to deliver, to process, and to observe at the nano level. Another revolution is this, and this is from our stem cell group in the Oxford Martin School. And this is second generation stem cell. So the first generation was when you took something from an embryonic cell, redirected it, or directed it to become pluripotent. And that had two big issues associated. One was the ethical issues for those that were concerned with them. And the second was the rejection issues, taking a foreign organism into another cell group. But this is a lab technician's skin redirected to be a pluripotent cell and then driven forward to be a cardiac cell. So this is the new revolutions which will allow the ability to basically manufacture different parts of our body. Another revolution, which is perhaps even more challenging, is associated with enhancement. The back mouse is a very happy wild mouse, and the front mouse is an even happier, slightly genetically modified mouse. The back mouse drops out after about 20 minutes, 200 meters. The front mouse goes for 2 hours, 2 kilometers. The capacity to hardwire, to change the way that ultimately we will be able to operate. It will make the discussions on doping in sport seem absolutely trivial today. And it's not only happening in the physical dimension, it's happening even more powerfully in the mental dimension. Now, we know already that there's massive engagement in chemicals for mood alteration. Something like 1/3 of the US youth, apparently, or young adults, or on some form of mood change, Ritalin, Prozac, whatever. But that is trivial compared to where the sorts of chemical enhancement discussions are going, where you can enhance your capacity to perform. And then the question is, who's going to decide how we're going to test? Is Warwick going to either test people before they do their entrance exams, or maybe to have a more inclusive thing so not only the rich kids can afford the drugs, send the drugs to poor kids so that they can be on a level playing field. These are the sorts of questions that will have to be asked in the future as it becomes more sophisticated. So lots of issues about where we're going and how we will change over time and who's going to be in control. Who's going to make the decisions? Is it going to be privatized? Is this just going to be about money? If you've got enough money, you'll enhance yourself, just like people do now with their faces or their tummies, tummy tucks, take away your wrinkles. But that doesn't change your income levels unless you're a model or something. What this will do is change your capacity to earn money. So it's going to be a very big issue. So we move into a world where we, the anthropogene, increasingly controls our future, where we have more power, but also more destructive power. And the problem with this period is we don't understand the risks associated with it. We don't understand what its unforeseen consequences may be. It's the tail risk, it's the wagging risk in the top right-hand figure. Very low probability, very high impact events that could transform the future of the world. Now, what I believe we've seen in the financial crisis is the first of such events, which are symptomatic of the sorts of crises that will shape the 21st century. These things that come from nowhere, that no one predicted, that shape our lives going forward. The interesting thing about finance is it's the best governed and best understood by far of all the global systems. There's over 20,000 people with PhDs from good places like Warwick and Oxford and Harvard who work in these international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and the BIS, whose job it is to create and to maintain global financial stability. We know in the UK that the financial institutions, the Treasury of all the government departments, the Bank of England, are the strongest of our institutions and actually have the best civil servants and staff. They also print the money so they can pay the highest salaries and have no resource constraint. And yet these institutions, whose job it was to do this, who are the most joined up because they meet a lot, they have these big meetings all the time, and they have the best data as well, did not see the financial crisis coming. So Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary, had been the chief executive of Goldman Sachs before. And many of us had grave reservations about him becoming the Treasury Secretary because we thought there was a conflict of interest with someone from the banking sector becoming the overseer, basically, of banks. But we thought at least he'd understand banking. And so it's quite remarkable when you look at the evidence that he gave to the Congressional Committee into the financial crisis, that one of the things he says when they pulled the plug on Lehman Brothers is we did not understand what was happening. We simply did not understand. And this is from someone who'd been the head of a big bank and had all the information at his disposal. Not lack of data that leads us to lack of understanding. It's a lack of imagination. It's a lack of understanding the pace of change, and in the case of the financial markets, the pace of technological change, which had led to the development of new instruments, derivatives in this case, which were totally unregulated by the market, that had evolved much more rapidly than the regulator's capacity to begin to understand them. Systemic risk is not new. It's estimated that up to half of the UK population was killed in the Black Death that entered through a process of globalization, maybe a rat on a ship. This is not new. What's new is the pace of change and the ability of this to spread around the world before it's understood. That's new. And here we see the spread of swine flu around the world, 130 countries within 6 weeks, exactly mirroring the airline traffic coming out of Mexico City around the world. And our future of pandemics, future of emerging infections group in Oxford with Angela McLean, who you know as a co-director of it, has done this work showing this exact match of the spread of swine flu with airline hubs and the way that it's distributed. In addition, we need to worry about new things. The pandemic equivalent of derivatives, what Warren Buffett famously called weapons of mass destruction, referring to derivatives. But we need to worry about the weapons of mass destruction that are dual use as well, as all of these technologies are. So DNA sequencing is going to revolutionize all of our lives. It's going to lead to a much better and more precise healthcare for all of us, which will be quite fantastic. At the same time, the capacity to create an Ebola or smallpox or something for $1,000 or few dollars is a very scary prospect. So how do you enjoy the upside of DNA and DNA synthesis without becoming more vulnerable to the crazies of the world? And the basic problem is that we live in a global village. There's no village elders, and there's major issues of managing the village commons, including the village crazies. So I'm less worried about traditional forms of conflict. Clearly, we need to worry about Iran and Iraq and other places. But I'm more worried about individuals. And one of the ironies of this process of globalization is that small groups of individuals have become extraordinarily powerful. In my mind, I think about them as pirates, people who know how to strangle globalization, just as the pirates did. Find the weak links and nodes and exploit them for whatever gain. We also need to think a lot about reputation, cascading information, and the management of the global commons. Now, global commons issues also are not new. Economists have had them in their literature from when they first started thinking about these issues hundreds of years ago. The problem was, how do you manage the tension between each individual putting their cow or goat on the village common, rational for each individual, when they all do it, the commons collapses. That's the problem of the commons, which is the same problem that we have now. Individual rationality does not lead to collectively good outcomes. What's rational for all of us that is not rational for our societies. So this is a big challenge, because economics has driven us down a path where we've come to believe that an economically rational man, that the market will reveal preferences which will lead to collectively good outcome. And what we saw in the subprime crisis is how naive and self-destructive such a view is. But we know that markets don't deliver. They don't deliver on global commons failure. This is the Tokyo fish market about 6 weeks ago. This is a rare tuna being sold for $750,000. Each plate of sushi is over $1,000. That's the market response to the scarcity of this type of tuna. You put the price up. And you have more fishermen chasing the final surviving tuna until they're none. So I have no doubt that next year these tuna will be going for $2 million. The market will price scarcity, but it will not solve the problem of scarcity. Countries also are not very good at managing this. This is a project I was unsuccessfully involved in when I was at the World Bank, the Aral Sea. Each country was doing the rational thing. They were drawing water to feed their people. Six countries sharing this inland ocean, collectively a disaster. So how do you overcome the short-termism? And then we do have some good examples, like the Mediterranean. And climate change, of course, is going to be the most dramatic of these. And it's very complicated because of the stocks and flows issues, because the rich countries have spent the last 200 years putting the carbon up there and other greenhouse gases, and now it's the emerging markets that have to stop. And the dramatic changes that are required to go down to about at least 2 tons per capita per year are beyond our capabilities, at least beyond our capabilities while we still allow emerging markets to go through the energy transition that is necessary for their development. So this is a major, major global issue, and we have to focus on it with a Manhattan type of project. But there's no one focusing sufficiently on this, and as we speak, the discussions taking place in Doha on climate are falling apart. Too little, too late. Big focus on minor reforms. I've spent months of my life in negotiations on shareholding of the Bretton Woods institutions, Africa's increased seats, and many other things, and these are important things. But they are not going to make any difference to the future of the world, not on these critical issues. So we focus on the wrong and on the big story. There's hope that the new types of digital and other connectivity will lead to new sorts of awareness, that it will lead to an ability to understand, to transform information, to create information platforms that will lead to citizens' action, and citizens will force their politicians to act on the big global issues. That's the hope. But it's not clear that it's happening quick enough or widely enough. So we have this problem of cascading risk. I'm just going to end with five lessons from the financial crisis. The first is this tension between hyperconnectivity, which leads to enormous robustness and resilience and progress, but also huge vulnerability. The second is that there's no governance structure in place that is fit for 21st century challenges. We have a system that was created after basically the Second World War in a very different world dealing with issues. It's evolving at an evolutionary pace while the world is evolving at a revolutionary pace. The governance gap is widening. Behind this, there's technological change which is happening at an exponential rate, at a faster rate than in the past, and that the people that run the governance structures are further and further behind them. And we saw in the financial crisis, that which has at its root a failure to understand connectivity and particularly new instruments and their dispersion around the world. The fourth point, which I haven't had time to go into, is that economics and management practice is a cause of the problem as well as the solution. It's doing a lot of good, but it's doing a lot of harm. The just-in-time, sweat-your-assets, mark-to-market type of philosophies that are driven through business schools are forcing people to price short-term and not to think about the long-term. Building resilience is a bad thing on your balance sheet. Whether you're a hospital and it's the number of oxygen bottles or bandages that you have in your cupboards, or whether you're a car factory and it's the number of spare parts you carry, or civil service and the number of people you carry, it's all regarded as redundant and bad for your working capital balance sheet. And therefore, you push out your flexibility and you push out your suppleness in the system and you create something that's lean and mean with very long and tight supply chains, and that accentuates cascading risks and it makes you far less able to shock absorb when a crisis comes. To have the capacity, whether you're a hospital or a factory and a supply chain or anything else, to be able to deal with mismanagement. And the tragedy is that our advanced economies, because we've shot all our financial bullets, we're becoming less and less resilient. We're like sick patients. We have less capability to bounce back. The emerging markets have more and more capability. Their levels of investment in people and in infrastructure are rising while we are disinvesting. And that means they will become more and more competitive and we risk becoming less competitive. We can use the new technologies. We can map this. And this is work that we've been doing with Andy Haldane and others at the Bank of England, and including Bob May, Professor of Zoology at Oxford. This is mapping the evolution of the financial system over the last 30 years. And what you see, the black lines derivatives development, the balls are nodes, is the development of this bottom right-hand big ball. That's Lehman Brothers. I believe if this sort of work had been done before the financial crisis and shown to those making decisions, they wouldn't have pulled that ball out of the system. It would have shown the systemic importance of this. And this is the sort of thing we need to do much more to understand the system, but also design competition and other policies which will stop this happening. Distribute systems. Ensure that no one node is too big to fail. Worry about geography. Worry about nodes. That is the source of vulnerability in globalization. So we have a most remarkable, resilient, globalized world. Something that allows us to do things and bounce back in a way that we never have before. But it's a great risk. People believe now, increasingly, that globalization is a source of problems, not opportunity. That more connectivity means more financial crises. It means more terror. It means more cyber attack. It means more pandemics. So people become more and more nationalistic and believe they can solve their problems at home. More and more xenophobic, that it's the foreigners that have caused this. More and more protectionist. Close down. Keep out foreign goods and services. This, of course, is extremely misguided. All the major issues that will affect the future of this society will come from outside our borders. That is the source of opportunity as well as the greatest threats facing Britain. So believing that you somehow can shut yourself off is just not understanding the dynamics of change in the world. And anyway, most of these things happen way before you even wake up, certainly cyber or pandemic. So one has to engage globally. One has to find the policies to manage it. It's not a question of creating some local is good past world in the hope that that will protect you. That would be disastrous not only for Britain, but particularly for the poor of the world. The poor of the world have the most to suffer from a lack of connectiveness, a lack of opportunity that's still to come to them. So we need to find ways of connecting with resilience, ways of being close but not being vulnerable, being ourselves but understanding more others, and using the technologies to help us and understanding the power of the crowd, the power of working together rather than alone in finding it. That's how we get to a much older and wiser age. Thank you very much. These are just some of the books that I've written that think about these issues and the website of the school. Thank you.